A reading from the first part of the book, The Case and Cure of a Deserted Soul, by the Puritan Joseph Simons, originally published in 1639. The godly are sometimes deserted. Though most men, since God and man parted in Adam, live without God in the world, Ephesians 2:12-13, and are so far from Him that they neither enjoy Him or know Him, yet there is a generation of men whom God has made nigh by the blood of Christ, with whom He has renewed that old acquaintance and amity which at first He had with them, and they with Him, which blessed estate, as it is not here perfected, so it is often interrupted. Their comforts are always sweet, but often short. There are but few, if any, whose joys in the comfortable communion with God are not sometimes clouded with sorrows and a doleful separation from Him, so that if you lay your ear to the door of their closets, you shall often hear the daughters of Zion, as heirs of their mother's miseries, complaining in their mother's language, "The Lord hath forsaken me, and my God hath forgotten me." Isaiah 49:14. If you fix your eyes upon them, you shall see Zion's tears in their eyes, her paleness in their faces, and her sorrow in their souls. In consideration of, and compassion to, these mourners, I spent some thoughts upon this sad subject. Desertions are either common or special. These which I call common are such as all men share in by nature, God having forsaken and withdrawn Himself from Adam and all his posterity, as well as apostate angels. The special I shall handle as they concern the godly or hypocrites. Desertions, as they concern men truly regenerate, are God's withdrawing Himself in respect of quickening, quieting, or comforting the soul. Desertions concerning men who seem to be regenerate are God's withholding those special influences by which they had a kind of life and spiritual comfort. To begin, then, with desertions, as they concern the godly, I shall first speak something in general of them, and then descend to the more specific. That which I shall say in general will comprise two things. Number one, that there is such an evil as spiritual desertion. Number two, how they are deserted. It is almost lost labor to prove that there is such a state, yet because as all in Christians is hidden in secret, so nothing is hidden in secret more than their comforts and discomforts, I will make it good by calling in two witnesses to give evidence of the truth. The first is the experience of the saints. Ask Zion. You have her verdict in Isaiah 49:14. And Zion said, "The Lord hath forsaken me, and my God hath forgotten me." You see here the church clad in all black, bewailing her widowhood, is one bereft of her dearest husband. Every word of her speech is bedewed with tears and bears a drop from her bleeding soul. The Lord Jehovah, He whose power and fidelity have been to me as the pillars of the earth, has forsaken me. He has cast me off. My Lord, who is mine in covenant, mine in communion, who has the joy of my life, the life of my joy, the strength, the stay, the spring of my life, has forgotten me. He has cast me not only out of His arms, but out of His heart. I am quite out of His love. Not only forsaken, but forgotten. And in this, Zion is not alone. Ask David, and you shall hear him as soon as you come near him, sighing, sobbing, crying, and roaring. But what does he say? What ails him? He tells you in Psalm 22:1, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? See how well their testimony agrees. How can a man look upon David and not count him as a poor orphan that is left in a woeful state, friendless, helpless, and comfortless? But yet we will hear a greater than David, that is the captain of our salvation, the first and head of the whole order. And what does he say? We will go no further to ask others. David was here a type of Christ, and as he was but the shadow of Christ's person, so his sorrow was but a shadow of Christ's sorrow. David merely tasted the cup which Christ afterward drank more deeply from, when in the anguish of his soul upon the cross he cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Matthew 27:46. And his cup has gone round ever since, so that few have ever tasted of the waters of life, but they have drunk also of these waters of Marah. The experience of almost all the saints contributes to the evidence of this truth. Where shall we find a man who has not met with these rocks and sands, and has not seen some gloomy days and winter storms, who has not passed through many changes, sometimes rejoicing like the plants in the spring, in the sight and sense of God's gracious presence, sometimes mourning again for his loss of God, sometimes lifting the soul up to heaven and mounting, as it were, on eagle's wings, sometimes again depressed to the depths of hell, and held as with chains of brass or iron, now quickened, but growing dull again. Few can say they have once found God who did not also say that they have often lost him. Add to the experience of the saints the witness of God himself, David, Heman, Job, and Zion might speak much out of distrust, impatience, and passion, but when God himself shall come in and confirm their evidence, it is past doubt that God does so. For does Zion bewail herself as a widow forlorn without a husband? God said it was so. The Lord has called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit, and a wife of youth. When thou wast refused, saith thy God, Isaiah 54:6. God said he had in a sense divorced her from him, yea, and whereas Zion complained that God forsook her, it is no more than God said himself in verse 7. For a small moment have I forsaken thee. So that this is sometimes the sad portion of the saints to be deserted. And this I have spoken, that the mourners in Zion may see that this uncomfortable state may consist with grace. It is a comfort to know that your depths are passable and your case curable. Others have walked in this heavy way and are now in heaven. Others have been in these storms, yet have safely arrived at the land of promise. No other affliction has befallen you than that which is common to men. Therefore, do not be overwhelmed in grief. Do not give yourself up as lost. Disquietness will hurt, but it cannot help. Rather, stir up yourself to take hold of God. Repent. Pray. Believe. Wait. For God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. 1 Corinthians 10:13. Chapter 2. How or in what sense the godly are said to be deserted? The second thing follows, how or in what sense they are said to be deserted. First, sometimes only in appearance, not in truth. Men are deceived in nothing as much as in themselves. Man's heart and ways, yea, his judgments and thoughts, are subject to many variations, and frequent mistakes are found in men's opinions about these great questions. Am I truly changed, or am I a hypocrite? Do I believe or not? Is God my God or not? And the errors of men's judgments arise from ignorance, unbelief, passion, and false rules of judgment, of which principles or errors I shall speak hereafter. But through such impediments men are often puzzled and think they are evil when they are good, and worst when best, and furthest from God when nearest to him. But his desertions are sometimes in appearance only, so sometimes they are real. God's truly withdrawing himself and denying that fullness and communion which his people were wont to have with him. But though he deserts them really, yet not totally, the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake. 1 Samuel 12:22. His truth is engaged in it. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Hebrews 13:5. The words are in the emphatic. Here we observe a duplication of the subject of the promise, I will not leave, I will not forsake. And there is a multiplication of negatives. There are five negatives in the promise by which he intimates that he will not, yea, he will not surely, he will not forsake his servants. He will never wholly reject them or utterly leave them. To clear this point a little, I will lay down three limitations or distinctions by which we may better understand in what sense this is the truth, that the godly are sometimes forsaken of God. God leaves them for a season, not forever. If he goes from them, it is but as one who goes from home to return again. I will not leave you comfortless or as orphans, but I will come again, John 14:18. When Zion was in this uncomfortable case, God said unto her, for a small moment I have forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath have I hid my face from thee, for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer. Isaiah 54:7-8. He may frown, but he will smile again. Though his compassions may be restrained, yet they cannot be extinguished. His anger endures for a moment, but in his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but in the morning joy comes. Psalm 30, verse 5. In his favor is life. Weeping may endure or lodge. It's a passenger to be gone in the morning, but joy comes in the morning as an inhabitant, and enjoy his habitation to himself. As the sun sets to rise again, and as the tender mother lays down her child to take it up again, so desertions are but short interruptions of a Christian's comfort. God will not tarry long when his people cry unto him. He will return and change their doleful winter into a joyful spring. Though the river has her ebbings, yet it has her flowings. The tide of comfort will come in again. There shall be a day of their joyful meeting with their beloved. They shall see their God, enjoy his presence, and be embraced in the arms of his love. And when this day shall come, there will be more joy in meeting than there was grief in parting. God will pour in comforts upon them as they have poured out tears for him. He will recompense their love with kindness, their desires with fullness, their mourning with gladness, and their short heaviness with everlasting consolations. Desertions are not the interruptions of God's love, but the acts of his love. His affection is the same, but the expression is varied. Note that there is a twofold love of God, or a twofold consideration of the same love. There is a love of benevolence and the love of beneficence, or as some call it, the love of intention and the love of execution. The former is to the faithful from eternity to eternity, and is immutable and incapable of any intensifying, remission, augmentation, diminution, or alteration. It is like God himself, unchangeable. But the latter, the love of beneficence, or of execution, which is his love as it expresses itself in doing good to us, may be in a degree suspended and restrained for a season. In the summer there is a light inherent in the sun and light flowing from it that is ever perfect and permanent, but this may suffer changes. It may be obscured and lessened, yea, extinguished, and quite cut off as in the night it falls out. A father may have a dear affection to his child, yet show but little in his carriage. David shut in his love from Absalom, not ceasing to love him, but forbearing the usual acts and expressions of his love. A fountain may have her streams cut off or dammed up, though it may have the same fullness and aptness to pour itself out as before. The root does not always give so much sap as to make branches bud and blossom at all times. Yet when she is most fearing in her beneficence, her goodwill is the same. She sticks as close to them as ever. We often keep back mercies from ourselves, and God would more abundantly pour himself in, but we do not open to him. And so, as that blind woman complained the house was dark when she was blind, so we often complain as if God restrained mercy when we ourselves restrain it. It is equally true that sometimes God is provoked by our sins and keeps his mercy in, that he does not come with such gracious visits as before. Yet his love is not shortened, though the fruits of it are. Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear. Isaiah 59:1-2. Though God may vary in the operations of his love, yet his love is in itself ever the same, and shall be the same forever. It is an everlasting love, Jeremiah 31:3. The hills may be removed, and the mountains may depart, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord that hath mercy on thee. Isaiah 54:10. This was spoken to the church in the day of her sorrow. He tells them that he loved them, though he afflicted them. And that speech of God to David is full for this purpose. I will visit their transgressions with rods, and their iniquities with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant will I not break. Psalm 89:32-34. When God deserts his people, he withholds those acts of love only that are for our well-being, not those that are for our being. Though a Christian may lack that without which he cannot have peace, yet not that without which he cannot live. Whatever is necessary to his constitution, life, completeness, and stability is never denied. No good thing will God withhold from those who walk uprightly. Psalm 84:11. He will ever hold their souls in life, not leaving them in weak beginnings, but continually leading on to perfection. As he is the author, so he is the finisher of our faith. Hebrews 12:2. We are confident of this very thing, that he that hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. Philippians 1:6. The saints shall have of him whatever is so necessary, that without it they cannot hold their state or attain therein, but that which is rather for their ornament than their support, for the sweetness of their way than the sureness of their end, for comfort rather than necessity may be, and often is, in great measure cut off and delayed. This, then, is the thing. When God leaves his people, he does not leave them to the will of the flesh, the temptations and snares of the world, the power and tyranny of the prince of darkness, as never or not at all to look after them. But his care is over them in these times, and he is with them by a secret maintenance, both guiding and upholding them, and is often most in power when least in appearance. The metals that lie deep underground do not see the heavens in their light, yet partake of their influence. Yea, ordinarily, the most precious operations of God's gracious power are there where there is the least sense and feeling of them, and they have most of God when they see him least, as when God covered Moses' face in the cleft of the rock, Exodus 33:22. He then passed by and enabled Moses to see his glory. So the clouds and veils that cover our eyes are often forerunners of the clearest light and sweetest sight of God. And when God seems to be turning a man into desolate and a ruinous heap, yet even then he is building and preparing him to be a more excellent structure. The gardener digs up his garden, pulls up his fences, takes up his plants, and to the eye seems to make a pleasant place a waste. But we know he is about to mend it, not to mar it, to plant it better, not to destroy it. So God is present, even in desertions, as though he seems to annihilate or reduce his new creation into a confused chaos, yet it is to repair its ruins and to make it more beautiful and strong. The glory of the second temple was greater than the glory of the first, Haggai 2:9. In the repairing of a house, we see how they pull down part after part, as if they intended to demolish it, but the end is to make it better. It may be that some posts and pillars are removed, but it is to put in stronger ones. It may be that some lights are stopped up, but it is to make fairer lights. So though God takes away our props, it is not that we may fall, but that he may settle us in greater strength. He batters down the life of sins to put us upon a life of faith. And when he darkens our light so that we cannot see, it is but to bring in fuller light. When the stars do not shine, the sun appears, repairing our loss of an obscure light with her clear, bright, shining beams. So then we see that, though God forsakes his people, it is not totally or forever, not ceasing the affection of love, but the acts, and not those which concern our being, but such as concern our well-being, namely abundant quickenings in aid of grace, victorious and triumphant power over sin, the clear and satisfying testimony of his Spirit. Chapter 3. Four other considerations about desertions. Having premised these things in general, I shall now come to the specifics of these desertions, and their several kinds. I will speak first as they befall the godly. Desertions, as they befall the godly, are of two sorts: the withdrawing of the influence of grace and the withdrawing of comfort. And that is either inward or outward, for all the complaints the saints make of God's hiding and withdrawing himself arise from one or all of these three grounds. God does not carry on their spiritual life as he was wont to do. He does not give that peace, joy, comfort, or assurance as he was wont to do. He brings them into outward straits and does not deliver them. Before I come to speak directly and particularly of these, I will propose four brief observations. Number one, a man may miss much of God's external presence in the sweet and comfortable way of his providence, providing, protecting, and ordering all occurrences to contentment, yet may enjoy inward communion with him. His soul may be most abundantly animated and quickened with the Spirit when he has the most discouragements without. Yea, God is wont, when he gives least in the world, to give most of himself. And his people seldom have much of the fatness below and the springs above at once, just as the sun and the stars do not appear together. But when he shuts up all doors of hope and help in the world, then he sets open the doors of heaven. So when Stephen saw nothing but death in the world, then he saw heaven opened and Christ sitting at the right hand of God, Acts 7. Such mercy Jacob found when he was a poor pilgrim in a strange land. Then he saw that heavenly ladder and the angels ascending and descending as a pledge of God's care and their readiness for his good, Genesis 28:12. The abundance of the Spirit, both of grace and peace, is usually poured forth in the day of sorrow. When the dough which the Israelites brought from Egypt was spent, God gave them bread from heaven. And there are reasons for it. The first is God's tender love, which is such that he will not add affliction to his people's sorrow. When therefore he is pleased in his wisdom to put a cup of affliction into their hands, he is wont to give them also the cup of consolation. When he casts them into outward straits, he recompenses it with inward enlargements. The church never had such full predictions of Christ and precious promises of great mercy as when the most dreadful evils hung over her head, as appears in the prophecies of all the prophets. And the faithful usually find their worst days to be their best days, and when they meet with troubles, they find most peace. This the apostle witnesses. As the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. 2 Corinthians 1:4. And though our outward man perish, yet our inward man is renewed day by day, 2 Corinthians 4:16. The second reason is that the capacity of the soul is widened and enlarged in affliction. Heavenly communion with God is sweetest in an evil day. And the soul longs after God so that in Him it may find all supplied, which it lacks in the world. Now the more God stirs up desires of Himself, the more the soul is prepared for communion with Him, and the more it has of Him. The hungry person eats most, and he that is most thirsty drinks most. When the life of nature and sense is cut off, the soul seeks a life in God, and is much in all endeavors of enjoying God. Now she seeks Him in prayer. She inquires for Him in the Word, and by all means reaches hard after Him. So David, when he was in the wilderness, panted and breathed after God. He prayed, he cried. His thoughts were with God all the day. Yea, in the night he meditated upon Him and said, My soul followeth hard after Thee. Psalm 63:8. Number 2. One may lack inward comfort, yet not be deserted with respect to the influence of grace. The tenor of grace and peace is not the same. A man may lose a sense of grace and yet retain the life of it, though he may be as holy who has grace without peace. Yea, and as a clouded summer sun yields more comfort to the earth than a bright shining winter sun, so when the soul is most clouded, it may be most quickened. When the light of God's favor is hidden, the quickening heat of the Spirit may most abound. Number 3. He who loses God's quickening presence also loses His comforting presence. Though a man may have grace living and stirring without peace, yet he cannot have peace without the life of grace. Peace and comfort are fruits of the sanctifying Spirit, and as there may be a root without fruit, but there cannot be fruit without the root, so though there may be the Spirit quickening and sanctifying without comfort, there cannot be true comfort without the quickening Spirit. One of the following two evils befalls a man from whom God has departed, and to whom the workings of the power of God are denied. First, he may fall into spiritual lethargy, being as one asleep, whose spirits and senses are bound up so that he is in a shadow of death, neither hearing nor seeing, nor tasting the things of God, and so is bereft of all spiritual joy and comfort. When a man is in the state of deadness, he is dead to all things that are spiritual, and they also are as dead things to him. The promises that are fountains of life to a living man are as dry and empty cisterns unto him. Yea, Christ, heaven, and the love of God, though they are the food, the strength, the life of a man in a healthful state, are to the languishing soul as meat to a sick stomach. The glorious things of the gospel are to him as a withered flower, or as a sealed book. He has no use of them. The other evil is to fall into spiritual frenzy. In a day of estrangedness from God, a man is often quite disquieted. Now the remembrance of his former blessed days torments his soul with grief and the fears of utter apostasy and irrecoverable declining from God vex a soul with fears and horrors. Yea, conscience may pronounce sad judgment upon him, and he may conclude that he is a hypocrite, an apostate, and one under wrath. So that either through insensibleness or unquietness of spirit, he who does not have his former vivacity and vigor of grace cannot have comfort in such a state. Number 4. All these may possibly befall a man at once. He may have outward straits and inward troubles at the same time, and this is the lowest pitch of misery that a believer can fall into. Chapter 4. Of the first sort of desertions, of the withholding of assisting grace. The first sort of desertion is with regard to spiritual life and grace, and it is either real or in appearance only. Concerning this malady and sickness of the soul as it is real, I will treat it in this order. Number 1, the state. Number 2, the symptoms and consequences. Number three, the causes. And number four, the cure. Number one, the state may be thus described. We are deserted by God when He suspends or withholds the arbitrary and wanted influence of the Spirit of grace. That I may more perspicuously express the thing, I will take this description in pieces and explain it in the parts of it. In a description are two things that require opening, the act and the object. The act is God suspending. It is a negative act, a not giving or putting forth that which was wont to be. It is not the taking of anything from a man which was inherent, but a denying of something that was assistant. It is a not taking out, but a not putting in. When a faucet is stopped or turned, there is no diminution of water in the vessel under it, but only no addition. The vessel is not emptied, but simply not filled. When a child is set down out of his father's arms, he is weaker, yet not by any loss of his own personal strength, but by the withdrawing of his father's help. The father does not take away any of his child's ability, but denies his own aid. So when God deserts his servant, he withdraws himself in his spirit. Yet we must conceive it not to be a spoiling of what he had planted in them, but a not conferring of that assisting grace which he was wont to give. This will be a little more clear in the next point. The next point is the description, is the object, or the thing which is withheld from a man in this case, which is the arbitrary or wanted influence of the Spirit of grace. Here are three things in the object to be observed. Number one, it is the influence of the Spirit of grace. The presence of the Spirit is one thing, and the influence is another. There may be the former without the latter. The influence may be abated, but the presence never fails. Just as the soul and the body is ever equal in her habitation, but not in operation, her power not acting, yet her presence continuing. Number two, it is the arbitrary influence of the Spirit which is suspended. There is a twofold influence of the Spirit. First, necessary and constant. Second, arbitrary and inconstant. The necessary influence of the Spirit is never denied, and it is that which God affords His people for life and growth. God is ever present to uphold His saints in life so that, though disease may molest them, yet their feet shall not be moved, they shall not sink. Psalm 66:9. Is that hand of power which wrought the creation work still in the preservation of all things? John 5:17. So the Spirit still works, and by a divine power supports a new creature, so that it shall not fall back into its first nothing. David found this hand of God staying him in the midst of all his weaknesses. Nevertheless, I am continually with thee. Thou hast holden me by my right hand. Psalm 73:23. So that life, being wrought by the Spirit of life, never dies. And as the Spirit works always to the conservation of spiritual life, so He ever works to the growth of grace. A Christian is ever growing. He grows while he seems to himself and others to stand still, yea, to decline. He grows always in reality, though not apparently or equally. As there are seasons in nature, so there are seasons in grace. Grace has her springs and autumns, but as nature is ever tending to perfection, so grace is ever ripening and increasing, yea, even in temptations and desertions. When God seems to leave His people, He is about this work, perfecting the new man. As in the lopping of a tree, there seems to be a kind of diminution and destruction, yet the end and issue of it is better growth. And as the weakening of the body by medicine seems to tend to death, yet it produces better health and more strength. And as a ball by falling downward rises upward, and water in pipes descends to ascend, so when the new man seems to decay, he is still carried on by the hidden methods of God to increase.
The plants are as well profited by the nipping blasts of winter, which cause not only the fruits but the leaves also to fall, as they are by the warm beams of the sun in summer. A Christian is a member of a thriving body in which there is no atrophy, but a continual issuing of spirits from the head. Ephesians 4:16 and Colossians 2:19. Every part is supplied by the effectual working of the Spirit of Christ, so that the influence that tends to life and growth is necessary and certain. But there is another influence of the Spirit, which I call arbitrary, which is given and withheld according to the pleasure of God. This is assisting grace, or God's gracious concourse, with that habitual grace which He has wrought in His people. I call it arbitrary because, though all grace depends upon and flows from His good pleasure, yet in this God is free. He has more absolutely promised to conserve and increase holiness than to quicken, actuate, and excite that principle of life. This He does with great variations according to His good pleasure, being more mightily present by the working and actual aid of His Spirit to some than to others. Yea, more to the same man, at some times and in some conditions, than to others. Sometimes the same Christian is as a burning and shining light, sometimes as a smoking flax. The Spirit bloweth where it listeth, John 3:8. Sometimes He fills a soul with fuller gales. Sometimes again she is calmed. A man has more at one time than at another. This assisting grace is to actuate, regulate, and corroborate. Actuating assistance is that by which God carries His people to action and fruitfulness, causing that inward seed which He has sown to bud and bear. This God works first by exciting and blowing up that latent spark of grace in the heart. Grace is an active thing, yet it needs to be excited because of the indisposedness of the subject in which it is. Though fire is apt to burn and be very active, yet when it is in wet wood, it needs blowing upon because it meets with strong opposition in the subject, the wetness of the wood, which gives check unto the active spirit of fire. Besides this contrariety in us, in whom the flesh lusts against the spirit, so that without assistance we cannot do the good that we would, Galatians 5:17. There is an external impediment, Satan assaulting with all possible quenching coals, so that he may cast a damp upon the soul. Therefore we need to be quickened by a continual influence, and this God is pleased to give to His servants. Jeremiah found this work of the Spirit to quicken and stir up His graces, which began to flag. Impatience and passion began to stifle His zeal and readiness in His ministry. But God came in to help him and blew up that spark, so that he said, "It was in mine heart, as a burning fire shut up on my bones, and I was weary with forbearing, and I could not stay." Jeremiah 20, verse 9. When this is denied, there is much deadness, dullness, and slumber in the soul, so that a man shall see it is not with him as in former days when the Lord was more graciously present and assistant to him. Second, God works by enabling us to act. It is not enough that God has given habitual grace, or that we are excited and come to the bud and blossom of holy desires, holy dispositions, and holy resolutions, but we still need the help of His power that these blossoms do not fail, but that we may bring forth the fruit of action. There is a seminal virtue of bearing in a tree, yet unless it is helped by the influence of the heavens, it cannot bring forth fruit. It is God that gives not only to will, but to do. Philippians 2:13. There is a power of God that works in those that believe. Ephesians 1:19 and Colossians 1:18. And according to the working of this power is a Christian's fruitfulness. When God is pleased to put forth His hand to take hold of him, to draw and enable him, he runs with joy and speed in the ways of God. His affections are inflamed, his heart is prepared, and he is apt to do good and receive good, and walks with delight with God. But when God shuts in his wanted mercy, then he walks heavily, and his soul is now full of complaints. I would, but I cannot. There are desires and good inclinations, but they do not come to perfection. The soul conceives and travails with purposes and says, I will look to my ways that I do not offend. I will pray more, mourn more, and do more, but it lacks the strength to bring forth. Therefore the godly cry for help, which they would not need if they had a sufficiency in themselves. Assistance is to regulate and order a man in doing good. This is necessary, for often there is much readiness, life, and aptness to do good, but yet much failing in the manner of it. The same Spirit, therefore, that directs us to what we should do, teaches us how to do it. How often are the godly in that case, that they would fain humble their souls and afflict themselves, yet they do not know how to do it? How often are they bent to other duties, yet they do not know how to do them in a spiritual manner? What the Apostle said, if one duty is true of all, we know not how to pray as we ought. Romans 8:2. Therefore the Spirit helps our infirmities, and by gracious conduct leads us that we walk aright. As a master guides the hand of a young writer to write according to his copy, and as a father in leading his child draws him because he is unwilling, helps him because he is weak, and guides him because he is apt to lose his way, so God has said not only to draw, Song of Solomon 1:4, John 6:44, and to help, Romans 8:26, but to order and direct his people, Psalm 37:23, Psalm 119:133, in 2 Thessalonians 3:5, a ship may be rigged and have a fitness to sail, yet lacks a wind to move it and a pilot to guide it. Assistance is to corroborate and fortify in some imminent difficulty. Suppose a man was mightily assaulted by some strong lust and was armed with occasion, opportunity, and Satan's strong power. In such a case, God is wont to underprop and shore up the soul with strong aid. How can a bruised reed stand against such a blast? When a father sees his child likely to be devoured by some ravenous creatures, he makes supply of the child's weakness by his own strength. The Apostle Paul was in some great temptation. Satan had shot some arrows at him, but God did not allow him to fall. He held him up. His grace was sufficient for him, 2 Corinthians 12:9. At another time, Satan took up other weapons, assaulting him with the terrors of troubles and death. He brought in an emperor against him, whose power and majesty he thought would daunt Paul. But God was a pillar of strength to him, so that he was not moved. All men left him, but God did not leave him. The Lord stood by me and strengthened me, 1 Timothy 4:17. In afflictions and hard seasons also, this assistance is wont to be afforded. The same apostle also found God when he was put to many a hard shift for his living. He passed through nakedness, hunger, thirst, and want, which would have broken the heart of most men. But, said the Apostle, I can do all things through Christ that strengtheneth me. Philippians 4:13. Thus God is wont to stand by his servants in hard times, but when he does not come with supplies and aid, they fail and faint. Temptations overcome them, distresses overwhelm them, and difficulties daunt them. Thus we see what that arbitrary influence of the Spirit is. But there is another thing to be observed. Desertion is a suspension of the arbitrary influence which we were wont to enjoy. For note, there is a twofold influence or assistance, extraordinary and ordinary. The extraordinary is when, in some unusual case, God moves in with more abundant help, leading the soul in triumph over all assaults, mightily corroborating not only valiantly to withstand them, but also gloriously to conquer them.
And this comes upon extraordinary occasions, so it ceases usually with the occasion, and the ceasing of it is not desertion. The ordinary assistance is that which a man usually has in the course of his life. When this is abated and withdrawn, then a man is deserted. When a man is not what he want, not so cheerful, ready, or constant in doing good, when he does not, nor can do as he was accustomed to doing. Time has been when he lived more with God, but now his heart has fallen from that heavenly communion with him. He could formerly mourn bitterly in the remembrance of his sins, but now the heart is frozen and cannot relent. He could have prayed with much affection and holy boldness, but now the heart is cooled, weakened, straightened, and indisposed. When it fares thus with a man, he is deserted. But here I will add a few advertisements to guide the judgment in this point of God's withdrawing his assistance. First, God never denies it wholly to a faithful soul, though some degrees of divine help are denied so that the soul languishes in a way and sinks into a state of deadness and dullness, yet there is life both habitual and actual. God's clock never stands still. There is no such delinquency of grace, no such swoon of the new man in which all acts of God cease. It may be so ill with the Christian that he may fall from his first love in a great measure. Revelations 2, 4, and 5. He may be much impaired so that there may seem to be the only remains of what there was before, and these remains may be ready to die. Revelation 3, 1 and 2. But God will not quite depart. He will keep the root, and the seed of God shall remain in him. 1 John 3, 9. Yea, and the husbandman is ever in some measure dressing, pruning, and watering the branches of his vine, John 15:2, Isaiah 27:3. So though they may bear less fruit sometimes, yet at all times they bear some. A Christian may do less, but still he does something. For though he may lose some help from God, yet not all. If he cannot believe with that fullness of assurance and joy as before, yet he can pray. Or if he cannot pray as he has done, yet he can sigh, groan, and mourn. Take a spring under the ground. If it is stopped in one place, it breaks through in another. So it is with the Spirit of grace. If it is stopped in some parts, yet it shows itself in others. Though the sun does not yield an equal comfort to the plants, yet it yields a constant comfort. It retires sometimes in part, but never wholly. Yea, God often withholds his quickening virtue from someone, grace for the quickening and perfecting of another. He sometimes leaves faith in a poor estate, so that it may be very darkened and clouded with unbelief and atheism, to raise up fear, to awaken to watchfulness, and to enrich with spiritual poverty, so that the soul may mourn more seriously and seek more earnestly after God. Sometimes he takes off his hand that held down some present lust and allows it to show itself in monstrous shape and rage to pull down pride, advance humility, and put the soul more to seek to be strong in God. It is not every degree of suspension of assisting grace that lays a man in this forlorn estate as one forsaken of God, but desertion is an imminent abatement of it, so that there is an imminent decay of affection and fruitfulness, and an imminent increase of darkness and lust. A child cannot be said to be forsaken of his father when the father abates something of the height and fullness of his maintenance, but when he keeps from him necessary things. The child is forsaken when the father allows him to wander up and down, to go ragged and torn, pinched and wasted with hunger and cold, and does not relieve him. Though the son sues and entreats his father to pity him, you may say that God has deserted you when he leaves you under the pressures of unbelief and the power of corruption, and when, though you cry and call, supplies are restrained and you are allowed to walk in the valley of the shadow of death. Desertion is not to be judged by a partial indisposition and deadness, but a universal one. Not all suspicion of grace makes this mournful state, for as I have shown, sometimes God hides himself from one part for the quickening of another, and may be most abundantly present where he seems in great measure departed, as I shall show hereafter. But when a man is overgrown with deadness, which spreads over the whole man, so that a man is now less in affection, less in action, yea, unmeet, unwilling, unapt to do all good and use a means of good, being abated in all his former life and luster, then he is deserted. There may be indisposedness to some duties from a number of causes, but when a man is less disposed in all, then he is in this woeful state. Not every interruption of communion with God, not every present distemper and indisposedness argues that God has withdrawn himself. There may be cold blasts, stormy weather, troubled air, or dark clouds in the spring, yea, in the summer season. A man cannot conclude from some present chill or a numbness of spirit or from some storms of impetuous lusts that he is deserted. The deadness of a deserted soul is not a transient, but an abiding deadness. Not a slumber, but a sleep. Not a fit, but a state of spiritual numbness. As a mother who goes away and returns quickly is not said to forsake her child, so desertion is not a present, short abatement of God's quickening presence, but a continued cessation from some space of time. It may be long. Chapter 5, that a man may be deserted and not know it, with the causes and evil of it. I have done with the state of a deserted soul. The next things are the symptoms and consequences of it, which will give some help to a man to know whether he is in this state or not. And it is needful to declare the signs of it, for often men are in this lamentable case and do not know it. When Samson awoke from that sleep in which he lost his hair, it is said that he wist not that the Lord was departed from him, Judges 16:20. So it is true of many, God has departed from them, and they do not miss him until they awake out of their sleep. Question. But is it possible that man should be so besotted that falling from a blessed course of sweet communion with God, and is so grievous an estrangement from him, he should not perceive it? Can a man fall from such a height into such a depth and not know it? Answer. Yea, certainly, and there are diverse causes of it. First, there may be a great flush of spirit and much activity from false principles, so that a man may seem to be the same and enjoy God as he once did. If it is observed that he has lost much and the greatest part of his life stands upon other pillars, the vigor of nature, strength of parts, enforcement of conscience, respects to men, false joys, fanatical dreams, superstitious rules, even these winds often feel the sails, these weights move the wheels even when there is little of God. God's departure is gradual. As he does not come all at once, but by degrees, so he does not depart suddenly, but gradually. As the sun rises and sets by degrees, and as night creeps upon men before they are aware, so God by degrees estranges himself and leaves a soul to wither by degrees. In a body languishing and a consumption, there is not such an apprehension of the going out of life and the coming in of death as in him who receives a sudden mortal hurt. He who wastes his estate little by little is not as sensible of his decay as he that loses everything at once. So if a man should fall from a heavenly walk with God and from a flourishing spiritual state into a lifeless and barren condition all of a sudden, he would be more affected with it. But now his fall is gradual, and therefore it is less seen. A hill is sometimes drawn out into such a length that the descent of it scarcely appears. In God's way a man may descend daily yet, because his decay is, as it were, broken into so many small parts, he hardly sees it. Old age and gray hairs come slowly and surely. They come by stealth, one gray hair creeping after another, and here and there upon him they know it not, Hosea 7:9.
a decrepit, weak state steals upon men, their souls being like draining cisterns which empty themselves by drops, and so emptiness overtakes them before they see it. While they think they are rich, they become poor. Revelation 3:17. Number 3. Men lose much of God and do not know it because they rest too much upon other things that deceive them. Some things outside them cause them to err. First, a pride and conceit raised by comparing themselves with others worse than themselves. Number 2, the testimony and applause which others give them, especially if by many the godly or the wise, praise blinds and holds them in a sweet dream and of an imaginary excellency. Number 3, transient and fleeting gales. God now and then breaks in with potent working so that people may exercise gifts for him and for others' sakes. As a result, they may be built up when they indeed wither. Number 4, they do not consider, neither do they examine their estate. They lay down their watch and do not hold continual sessions for judgment of themselves. Therefore, changes befall them, and they do not know it. When men do not review their estates, they may grow poor and not see it. Conscience is the soul's watchman, yea, her judge. Now, if there is a vacation and the judge does not sit, a man may be despoiled of much of his estate and not be righted. Unless we judge ourselves frequently, we cannot know ourselves fully, but may lose and not see it. You see, then, that one may be deserted and not know it, but it greatly concerns a man to be vigilant, that he may discern God's accesses to him and recesses from him. For, first, otherwise, though he enjoys God, he cannot be thankful. It is not the presence, but the evidence and sense of mercies that raises thankfulness. He who does not receive and he who does not know that he receives are equally unthankful. When a man lies long out of the balance of judgment, he does not know whether he is better or worse. God may be present in many gracious counsels, checks, incitements, impulsions, and yet receive little thanks for his precious mercies unless they are observed. If a prince comes in favor to visit you and stands knocking, and it is not known, you cannot acknowledge that high favor with thankfulness. And though Christ stands at the door and knocks that you may open, that he may come in and sup with you and you with him, if you do not know this day of salvation and the season of grace, it cannot affect you. What sin this is! God is with you by secret workings of his Spirit. He is with you in your way and in the means of grace, and you do not observe it. But it is with you as with Jacob in another case, who sleeping did not know what had befallen him. But when he was awakened, said, God was in this place, and I knew it not. Genesis 28:16. Secondly, unless you know how it fares with you, if God has departed, you will lie still and not inquire after him. He who is sick and does not know it, does not seek a cure. The whole, that is, such as think that they are well, do not need the physician, only the sick. Such as feel their sickness and pain, Matthew 9:12. They who are rich in their own opinion do not seek for supplies, but say that they lack nothing, Revelation 3:17. He who is full will neither beg nor work for bread. He who thinks all is well and seems to be something when he is nothing, Galatians 6:3, is at rest, just like one who needs nothing. It is said that the Pharisees needed no repentance, Luke 15:7. That is, they knew no need because they did not see their sin. No man seeks that which he thinks he has, therefore look well to yourself, lest you are deceived. A man may go on with an opinion of a good estate and be mistaken. As the hungry man dreameth, and behold, he eateth, but when he awaketh, the soul is empty. And as a thirsty man dreameth, and behold, he drinketh, but when he awaketh, behold, he is faint, Isaiah 29:8. So you may be in a beggarly condition while you think you are rich, unless you search yourselves, and until you waken out of your dream and behold your misery, you will not seek for remedy. What brings a beast to the river
but thirst and heat. That man will not seek for the well of life who feels no lack. Necessity is a mother of industry, and no indigence breeds diligence. Thirdly, it is a contempt of God not to observe what interest you have in him and what communion with him. If a friend, much more if a king, came to your house and you took no notice of his coming in or going out, will you not take it ill and count it a great neglect of him? Is it not a sign his company is not valued, whose presence is not accepted, and whose absence is not regarded? Things that you prize, you keep with care, possess with joy, and lose with grief. A small matter may be lost and not missed, but if a jewel is lost, it is soon missed. Consider, if a husband had occasion of departure for a season, and the wife were not loath to part with him, nor grieved to have him gone, would not all say that she did not love him? When you make a feast, you do not sit down until the chief guest comes, and when he comes, you meet him with all fit respect and kind entertainment. If then you sit down and make merry with the creatures, when God has not come in to sup with you, Revelation 3:20, or if you entertain your pleasures, delights, profits, and other worldly contentments, and give but slender heed and respect to God, so that his presence or absence is not much to you, it is a sign that he is not your chief, but that you despise him. Therefore, be careful to observe diligently how God is with you, that you may not lose him and not see it. For this is to condemn him. At this, that God's withholding himself is a sign of his displeasure, and is a great provocation to slight it. That was a reading from the book, The Case and Cure of a Deserted Soul, by the Puritan Joseph Simons, narrated March 12, 2008.